out parking tickets and leave me alone. Stick to something you know about.
Listen, my daughter was about your age. Then she met a guy like you. Now she's dead.
You still believe in ghosts, P-Brain.
He's a closet!
Don't hurt me, please!
Don't keep me waiting for those onions, Herman!
This is all the whiskey you possess?
Everyone out of the way of the bulldozer!
Hello and welcome to Hello, This is the Doomed Show. I am Richard. Folks, I am joined by a special guest. He's a writer, a director, and he told me not to mention it. He's a secret spelunker, but he's out now. I'm talking to Dan Wilder. Dan, hello.
Hey, how's it going?
Oh my God, it's better now that I'm talking to you.
Yeah, I spice up any conversation.
Muy caliente. I've heard you described as such.
Indeed.
But no, dude, we've been needing to have talked for like a long time.
Yeah, I mean, we've just do the little chats on Facebook, but that's just not the same.
No, we're breaking out of our social media holes to climb into a different hole, I guess.
Difference. Yeah, exactly. It's much different. You can hear my voice now. That's about it.
Yeah, that's the most important part. So, folks, if you don't know Dan, we're going to talk about all the things that Dan does do. Let's get into your filmmaking, dude, because like I have been lucky enough to review one of your films, or have I reviewed two now? I think just one.
Yeah, you. I think you reviewed Ouija Room, which used to be called Haunting Inside, but when a distributor gets a hold of things, they change the titles.
I reviewed that and the short. I reviewed
Mercury Screams.
Yes, thank you. I was always really impressed because I, of course, have tried to make films. Like, and the longest film I made was 28 minutes. And the reason it was 28 minutes, because there was no script. And every scene was just us talking until the idea that I basically laid out got communicated. And then we moved on, which meant long takes with the video camera audio taking, just capturing all that magic of a bunch of librarians just talking. Because of course, everyone in my movie was a librarian. But I find filmmaking very difficult in that I feel guilty for wasting everyone else's time. Because you have friends and you have like, or people, even worse, people you barely know hanging out for 16 hours so they can say a line. How do you yeah. deal with that kind of like that kind of nightmare?
Well, it's situational for sure. The short that you reviewed, Mercury Screams, and we'll get back to that later if there's more to say about that. That was filmed in about 4 hours.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah. Here's the deal. We filmed it at my in-laws' house, Caitlin's parents' house, my wife, Caitlin. And they were moving in. So we had that amount of time to shoot what we were going to shoot and get the hell out of it.
Before the moving van arrived.
Yeah, it was awesome. It was supposed to be a 50-degree day. It was 28.
Wow.
I had, this poor girl lying fully nude on the floor of the house with no heat.
Oh, jeez.
And then I ran her around outside in a sundress, so I felt like the world's biggest asshole. And then on the opposite end of the spectrum, I directed a film called Babysitter Massacre Heavy Metal. It is going to be third in the Babysitter Massacre series by Henrik Koto. And that's not out yet, but we made it pre-COVID, pre-pandemic. And that was the exact opposite. Like, I had people show up in the morning and they weren't even going to film until the end of the day. So when they're just sitting around, I put their asses to work. I make them, help with costumes, help with makeup,
nice.
Help me get craft service. I make all the food when I make a movie. Because one, it's economical. And two, home-cooked meals, people respond to that. You know, it's not just a freaking cardboard pizza in a box, you know. here's your freaking Domino's, and I get back to work. Because you're asking a lot of some people, especially in the horror genre. You've got people sitting around dressed up as monsters. You got people sitting around getting ready for effects. You got people sitting around, you know, getting ready to lay naked on a 28-degree floor. You got all sorts of wacky stuff going on, but you just kind of make the best of it. But I feel that since we are ultra low budget independent features, if you're on set, you pretty much know you're going to get wrangled into doing some job.
So you did the third Babysitter Massacre.
Yes.
Were you involved with the other two, or is this was you were lucky enough to kind of like step in to go crazy with the third one?
Well, Henrik is my friend from a while back. He first contacted me to write a script on spec for a feature for ITN releasing that never got, it just never came together. It just never got made. So he's like, well, let's make a movie we can make real quick. I want it set in a house. You know, he gave me the basics, and that became Haunting Inside, which is a Ouija room, which you can watch on Amazon or whatever. Or don't watch it at all. I don't give a fuck what you do, but wait, can I swear on this?
Of course. I'd be worried if you didn't.
I've listened to your show and everything, but I don't remember where you can swear and where you can't. And I swear a lot. So
we mark it as explicit just to be safe.
Good. You're going to need it for this. So, Henrik was like, well, I want to start working on a series of sequels to my movie Babysitter Massacre. And he's like, would you just spitball some ideas for the second one with me and write a novelization of the first movie? So I'm like, shit, yeah, I'll write a novelization. That's awesome. I don't care. So I don't say no. Like, I like to work every minute of every day. So if people want me to do something, I'm just so happy to be doing anything. So anyway, so we got, this is such a long answer to this freaking question. So
I'll take it.
So we worked together. We worked on a lot of projects. Around that time, we got involved with Fred Olen Ray,
awesome.
Who I'm sure I know you know.
Oh, yeah.
And we did 6 episodes of a Boggy Creek television series.
Cool.
That's available on Amazon right now if you have Prime. It was free. I don't know if you have to pay for it. Fred wrote the first 2 episodes. I wrote episodes 3 through 6. Henrik directed all of them. And then from there, he's like, well, you know, I started to tell him about how I wanted to get into directing. I'd only done the short at that point. And he's like, well, why don't you do Babysitter Massacre 3? It was 4. I get tripped up because originally ours was 4.
Oh.
We got bumped to 3. There's a 4th one coming that I'm going to write. And that's still in the cards. You know, it's so hard because everything got all screwed up because something happened and I don't know.
I haven't heard about it.
So that's where we are there. So that's how I got to be involved in that. And he said that it only had to be tangentially related.
Yeah.
So I was able to do whatever I wanted, which of course was a heavy metal horror film. And that's exactly what I did. I'll tell you a little bit about it. A kid gets fed up with his life and he ends up getting possessed by a dead rock star, and then everything goes to hell from there. So you know it's gonna be a fun time for sure.
I'm excited to get my eyes on that.
I can't wait for you to see it. It's always the hurry up and wait game, you know, when you do these things, movies or whatever. You hurry, you go at a mile, you know, a mile a minute, and then all of a sudden it's 3 years later and you're like, wait, that's not out yet. What the fuck is going on? So you know, that's what happens all the time.
Well, I was excited. I think I found Ouija Room at Walmart.
Yeah,
and that blew my mind. I was like, I know that guy.
I know, it blew my mind too. It's just surreal because, like, I'd grow up and then every Halloween we'd be all excited about the Walmart display.
Yep. Oh yeah,
you know, I grew up in the same town as our mutual friend Shane Migliavacca, the Cathode Ray Mission. We've been best friends for 30 plus years. So, and we grew up in the ass end of nowhere, absolutely nowhere. But what we had was like eventually a Walmart, but what we did have was a lot of mom and pop video stores that, you know, would let us rent anything and everything. And they got the gnarliest crap that you can imagine, SOV stuff and, you know, Fulci films and nice. All the crap that makes us, you know. So
yeah, we had the Blockbuster syndrome hit our town pretty hard. I was in the Jupiter, Florida, a town so wonderful that they based a season of American Horror Story in it. And so we had the Blockbuster, but they hadn't blockbustered everything. You know, when they their mission was to have 85 copies of Pretty Woman ready, so they had to get rid of all these other movies that they had plenty of space for. And but before they got rid of everything, I could trick my mom into letting me rent stuff, like that 17 plus sticker that that Blockbuster put on there. I was like, Mom, they put that on everything. I totally like lied to her to get to rent Hellraiser 2, and
that's great.
Scare the shit out of myself.
Yeah, I mean, my parents were always into this stuff, into horror and everything. So like, I got cool with some crazy stuff real quick, because if they wanted to go see a movie, I was going too.
Yeah.
And it didn't matter what it was. But the mom and pop stores were even more outrageous. Like, I remember they got in this minuscule selection of anime, and they had Yuri Tsukidoji, Legend of the Overfiend.
Of course they did.
Of course they did. Let me rent that one. I strolled right out of there with that
one.
Oh, no. Oh, yeah.
Oh my God. I didn't watch that till I was a grown-ass man, and I was like, yeah. Whoa, dude.
I mean, it explains a lot of why I am like I am. That and a bunch of shit that I'm sure we'll get into.
Dude, that's freaking amazing, though. I'm always curious to see, like, how these things shake out, especially we'll talk about like some of your favorite directors, some of your favorite films and everything. But like, I feel like with Mercury Screams, you really had your influences on your sleeves. Like, that was no holds barred, you doing whatever you wanted to do and mm-hmm. really making something that feels like that tape you find in an abandoned house, or like a transmission from a pirate TV station you weren't supposed to see. I really, really enjoyed that.
That's exactly, you know, what I wanted to nail with it. We grew up close to Canada, so we'd get all sorts of weird Canadian stuff, and then we get some, just, you know, regional stuff, because we didn't have cable for a while. So, you know, we get exposed to all these weird people. Well, PBS, of course, we had that channel.
Yeah.
You know, and they'd play all sorts of weird stuff. And then I remember once in fifth grade, we read the book Lizard Music. Did you ever read that book?
No, I haven't heard of that.
It's a kid's book, but it's about this kid, and his parents leave him home alone. And his sister, like, is just like, screw this, man, I'm out of here. I got a guy to screw somewhere across town. So he's alone all the time. So he starts watching TV late at night, and what he finds is a pirate station run by lizards. And they're broadcasting all these strange shows, right? So that always stuck with me. Like, what Weird. Would that be like? And then, like, I heard about, like, you know, the Max Headroom incident. I don't know if you've heard of that.
I have.
Yeah, signal interruptions and things like that. And I got really into that. And number stations. I'd find, like, logs of number stations and just listen to those. And it was a conglomerate of that stuff mixed with some true... true is in the eye of the beholder, I suppose. Paranormal incidents that happened to my family are worked in there as well.
Wow.
And then it's expanded. The story has expanded. I am working on a longer version of it, which I know I've mentioned to you.
Yes.
And if you think that the short was out there, I can promise you ain't ever seen anything like this.
Oh, that's good news. I like that.
Yeah. Nice. And the new one is, I paid. So I don't know what the hell I was doing when I made a short. I just figured I could do it because I'm too stupid to not know that I can't. So I went out there and I was like, I can make a movie. I got it. So, you know, I'm throwing fucking money around left and right. Now, listen, I don't work. I'm a stay at home dad. Yeah. So, not throwing my money around. I'm throwing Caitlin's money around. So so thank God for Caitlin, who makes all of this possible. There's her little shout out there. But anyway, so like, I paid too much for everything. I paid for a lot of things that I could have done myself. Mm-hmm. I think, I wanted a really good monster. So I actually paid a professional to make that creature. That was a custom made creature for the film. Nice. I drew it all out and then he sculpted it beautifully and made it come to life.
Wow, nice.
And that's all for the short, you know? And I'm like, I feel bad about making this girl lie on the floor. Here's a little something for you for your time. And here's, like, you know, you can't expect, you know, I don't want to torture people for sure. But so when it came time to do this new one, I challenged myself to make it for no money at all. So it incorporates a lot of techniques. There's a monster in this one, but for instance, I built the monster in my living room. And I might have sent you those photos online. I know
you
the
did.
People listen.
You definitely
it's
did.
Not, it's not going to mean shit to them. But yeah, so I constructed a puppet, which I filmed in front of a white wall in my living room. And then my editor, JB Sapienza, he's my brother-in-law, a very talented filmmaker. And he, you know, is putting this creature on top of footage that my actress, Mary Liz Adams, a shout out to her too, because she's incredible. And she's also in Babysitter Massacre. And awesome. she's in a couple other things that we shot during the pandemic, which I can hint about but not talk about, because everything's like being in the fucking Justice League when you work on no budget movies. So so like we're doing a lot of that. We're doing some animation. We're doing we're still filming it. Like the character in the story has to, for those that don't know, has to record everything in her life because of a past traumatic event. So that's where the found footage angle comes in. Cause I don't want to just have that as a gimmick and not explain it, you know,
yeah.
And more than just, well, the camera was accidentally left on, but you know, so I want, it becomes organic, but she has to record everything. And in the process of making this movie, JB and myself have found ourselves with this app. We have this really cool, camcorder app on our phone. That's what we're filming it with, just, you know, because it's gonna look like shit. It's supposed to look like shit. So we went out and we're still finding and filming things, and we're like, Jesus, this thing's like taking on our lives, like it's taking over, you know, because we're still filming cool stuff that we found, like, oh, here's footage of a moth, we can use that in there for something, or, you know, it just goes on and on and on. So
yeah, I gotta find a way to reel it in, to bring it all, everything has to mean something and everything.
Yeah, there's a lot of, you know, arty farty bullshit in it, of course. But it's gonna, I think if you like, well, I hate to say found footage because that gets such a connotation sometimes, but it is found footage. If you like found footage, but you also enjoy, you know, Eurosleaze and psychotronic cinema, then you're gonna love this too. You know, it's just all these genres mashed up into one.
Nice. So. Yeah, the one thing I thought of during the first lockdown, you know, was some intrepid filmmakers are going to be sneaking out,
yeah,
and running around and making something, because like that was the first thing people were talking about, was it feels apocalyptic. I mean, I'm driving down freaking Del Mabry, the big road up by us here, and it was like me and six other cars. And I'm like, this is
that's awesome.
People aren't even dead yet, and I'm loving this.
Well, you know, and you're right. Like when this thing hit, I was like, I have to find a way to continue creating and working. I don't want to just stop. Yeah. And I mean, not to sound, you know, like A Star Is Born or any shit like that. Maybe not the ending of that. But what I did is I'm not a young guy by any means. And I finally got this break that I needed. You know, I was working in the video game industry and then I got laid off right when we were having our first kid. And my wife was like, you stay home and watch the kids, cause that's cheaper than getting daycare up here is ridiculous.
Right. Yep.
It's so expensive. And I don't really want other people watching my kids, cause I'm, you know, paranoid maniac. So, what I did is, you know, and then she's like, well, why don't you start working on this film stuff that you've always wanted to do, you know? And it just started going right from there. Like I was talking about the stuff with Henrik, and then it snowballed into this stuff. And then COVID hit and I was like, cause I don't need any more setbacks, you know?
No.
No one needs any more setbacks.
Not in this day and age. Oh my God.
Right? Right, exactly. And I was like, shit, you know, if we do found, if Henrik came to me with some ideas and then this Mercury Screams thing, I was just like, this is perfect because like I didn't have contact with anyone. I gave everyone the app. I gave everyone their scenes. I told them how to block it out to some extent. Some of them I didn't have to. Some of them I just trust. Like Mary is amazing. She knows exactly what to do just from what she reads in the script. And then I'd get the footage back and then we'd do what we needed to do and stuff like that. But it was such an amazingly organic way to make a film and totally different than the short version of it or even, you know, Babysitter Massacre, which was just a straightforward shoot. You know, it's just like any other shoot. You block out your days and you get all your shots for the day and, you know, you're on your way. With this, it's just like, it's still happening. That's what's weird about this movie that we're, or this, it's not even a movie, this thing that we're making that's just, I don't know.
Well, I look forward to whatever it turns out to be because I think it's going to be this epic freaking thing. Like, I just anticipate this, like, multimedia firestorm of this coming out. Like, I could see, like, weird links and hidden things and, like, even if you just get to, like, the DVD or the Blu-ray where it's, like, massive strangeness. Yeah, like, make it so...
Yeah.
So different and strange where, you know, instead of play menu, mm-hmm. it's all symbols and strangeness, you know, go nuts, awesome. You know,
video producer, man, Richard Schmidt, here he is.
I'm an ideas man. I am really bad at any kind of like know-how, but I got some shit.
and that's awesome. Cause I think the one thing, I mean, I like the Blair Witch Project for what it is. I mean, I know a lot of people just really love it, but the one thing that they did, and a lot of people really hate it, but the one thing that they did that was absolutely genius was that online shit because nobody had done that before. And you go to that website and it was just so rich with that mythology and the, the supposed stories and this, that, and the other thing.
And the it's books like, wow. And the comics and all the weird little stuff. Yeah.
What an amazing thing that they did with that movie, you know, and then totally fucked that up later on, but whatever, but you can't win them all.
No, you know, it was, I mean, I'm a big, big fan of that. Like, I was never convinced or fooled that it was real. I went into it somehow. Somebody had just told me straight up that it wasn't real. So I was not...
So you'd already seen Cannibal Holocaust and you knew how these things go?
Well, at the time, I was definitely less of a horror fanatic. Like, my horrors, all my horror... I want to say genomes. That's not even the right thing. Went dormant. And I just was like... into like artsy films and I was into like just weird abstract stuff. All horror would bubble back to the surface in the early 2000s. It's like,
was that like the Tarantino effect? Like he came out and then you got into stuff because he was not that
pretty much
about his influences as much as if I'm just saying, well, yeah, maybe his influences too. Cause he would be talking about John Woo movies and
exactly. The 90s was all about that independent and foreign film market because the horror that was being mass produced was pretty bad. Like I have a lot of affection now for 90s horror. Looking back on it at the time, it just alienated me from what I loved about horror and I just got sick of it. And it was very easy to let horror go for a while because I find out later, there was great 90s shit, but you had to dig. And what did Blockbuster do? They buried all that stuff.
You're not going to be finding that stuff.
So when I got back into horror, but yeah, for Blair Witch Project, it was just having a great crowd and a great theater experience and just being blown away. And then talking about it with my friend on the drive home, because we went to the middle of nowhere to go see it. And on the way back, we're driving in fog on the highway at night as the temperature is dropping as much as it can in Tampa, you know, and just being terrified talking about what we'd just seen and just that experience of having it get crazier. It's like, you know, a lot of people hate remakes, but The Ring, in 2002. That was one of the reasons why I got back into horror, because I had never heard of Ringu. I knew there was a tape that killed you after 7 days. Mm-hmm. And then the movie fucking shows it to you. And so mm-hmm. in your brain, you're like, I'm dead in 7 days.
Okay. But isn't that cool? Just for a second?
Exactly.
Just for a second, you know?
And my wife, when she was my girlfriend at the time, we were dating. It was one of our first date movies. We were destroyed by The Ring. We couldn't stop seeing whatever her name was, Samara, whatever it was in the American version. We'd see her in the corner of the room while we were talking. And just like, ugh, we were so messed up.
Yeah,
so that's what got me going again. But yeah, I'm nuts about Blair Witch. So and the books and the comics and all that stuff. And even part two, I even love part two.
Yeah, you and Shane, there's that name again.
Yeah, he and I are we're ridiculous for that movie.
I went to the movies to see it with him, so I know.
Oh, wow. The 2016 one, it also exists.
I haven't even seen that.
They ruined the best moment in the trailer. There's a moment in that movie that is like shit your pants, jaw dropping, and totally clever and perfect. And they freaking put it in the trailer. The mm-hmm. best moment
yeah,
is
great.
In the trailer. And that's back when I didn't know. That's why that's back when I didn't know better. Now, I don't watch trailers now. If I give a crap, I'm not watching that trailer.
Hey, you're better off not, because so many things are spoiled, you know?
Oh, yeah. So the what inspired me to talk to you, other than I've always found you very attractive, is you're talking about your comic book. You wrote, and did you write, how many issues is this going to be? Is this an ongoing thing, or is this like a finite number?
It's funny. The one that came out, there's four total issues.
Okay.
And the hardcover version that came out collects the first, there's a zero issue that I did not write. It was written before I got brought onto the project. And then it contains the first three issues that I wrote. And I'm pretty sure he's going to do something with that fourth issue, because it's probably going to be a bigger sized one, I would say. I don't know 100%. You know, once you write something for the comic book industry, that's kind of where you get left off. They don't really keep you in the loop, you know, on anything. So I wrote that series, Grave Cult, it's called. And then I have written a bunch of other books for him that have not come out yet. By him, I mean Everett Herzo. He's an outlaw comic book artist from the 90s. He created a character called Razor. She was like in that whole bad girl genre. She had like big blades on her hands, and she teamed up with a crow in a comic book.
Oh, nice.
So that's some cool shit. That's where I knew the guy from. And I was really excited to work with him. And he's cool. He's easy to work with. He doesn't make me do a lot of changes or anything like that. And I can put in whatever I want. So in this Grave Cult comic, he's like, I want it to be like a grindhouse movie, for want of a better term. And I'm like, oh, I'll give you that. I'll give you that right up. And I just went apeshit with it. There's dinosaurs, there's aliens, there's zombies, there's a Frankenstein monster that's Elvis, who runs a Jim Jones like cult.
Oh, nice.
There's strippers that are the heroes. There's a zombie that uses twin dildos as weapons, and he has a parasitic twin that
Holy
comes
shit.
Out of it. Like, I just lost my mind. Well, I mean, I always lose my mind when I do shit, because I just don't. My way of working is I would be damned if I let anybody tell me what I'm gonna fucking do. So I just do whatever I want to do, and it's the weirdest shit. And nobody says to me, "Hey, you know, you gotta calm that down." No one says it, so I just keep going. So you know.
Nice. Well, it's good that you had someone who was open to your madness. That's good.
Yeah. Yeah, it's just weird how things happen. Like, I've always wanted to write comics. I've always wanted to review films. I've always wanted to make movies. And now finally I'm doing all of this stuff. And I think the wonderful thing about it is that with the way the internet is, and you know, I'm sounding like grandpa now, but with modern technology, anybody literally can do this shit. It's not like, you know, I got some secret magic power that made me do all this stuff. I just contacted people. Actually, what I mean, I don't know. Do you want me to go into how I got to this point? It's a quick story.
Yes, please. Absolutely. Go for it.
What happened is I got laid off from work, so I could no longer afford my expensive boutique label horror movies that I enjoyed so much. So I found out that if I review movies, people will give them to me.
Yep.
So, and as you know, as you well know, and I'm sure everyone that knows that we review movies knows that we don't pay for that shit. I mean, that's why we do it. I don't get paid to review movies. I get paid in movies.
Exactly.
So I did that. And then I'd watch a lot of people liked my reviews because I swear a lot and talk about boobs and shit. And, you know, all the things that people love. And the independent horror guys would write to me and they're like, hey, you want to review my movie? You know, nobody's watching my movie. And I'd be like, yeah, I'll watch your movie. And then I'd ask them questions. Since I did them a favor for reviewing their movie, I'd be like, can I ask you some questions about filmmaking or writing or whatever? And then you make contacts. And then, you know, it just came about that Henrik needed that script for that movie that he was that we were going to pitch. And it all went from there. So literally anyone can do that. You don't have to do the reviewing part. You just, if you see your people online, ask them questions, you know.
And he strikes me, Henrik does, as a real doer. Like, he is prolific.
Yeah. And then through him, we also do the weekly spooky podcast, which yes. I produce, which is all horror stories from a variety of authors. Shane, of course. I have to shoehorn myself in there sometimes for the ego trip that I so desperately need. And and we just hit our 100th episode on that.
Oh, so, that's great.
Yeah. So 100 episodes in, you know, and then along with that, there's books that we wrote. There's the Campfire Stories book.
Yes.
That was an anthology book. So that's, you know, that's another avenue of things. And then through that, I was able to get Shane involved and things like, so it's good to, you know, get your friends involved. And
of course. I know you write for horrorfuel.com. Is there other sites? I mean, I know you have the Daniel 13 blog. What is the name of the blog? Or is it still going?
Well, it's now defunct. It was called the Outre Eye of Daniel 13.
Okay, thank you.
What happened with that was, that was an interesting story, and I'll definitely tell you. So I was working for Famous Monsters of Filmland, and I developed that whole shtick, the Daniel 13 character, pretty much on there, which isn't really a character. It's just pretty much how I talk, and I'm a goofy bastard. So is he. So, so I was working for them for a while, and then they just changed up what they were doing, their business model or whatever. And I was kind of just floating around waiting for another website to pick me up. So I started that blog in the interim, and then I got picked up by Horror Fuel, which is where I've been for a while now.
Yeah. Excellent. I'm always impressed with your good attitude. And it's like, you do not like lay into a film with the freaking knives out to start some shit. Like, you are very forgiving in some cases. And you're like me, where you're at an age, a certain age. I'm not sure if, hopefully you're younger than me.
I don't know about that one.
we'll compare sizes later. But you want to make an excuse for like your time. Like, you want to say, this was an experience I lived, this hour and a half that I just went through, and I want to make it worth my while. So I'm going to go into it with, you know, at least a slight smile and enjoy it for what it is.
Yeah. And another thing too, is that my reviews are more about, are based on feeling. Like, what did the movie entertain me? Was it filled with everything that I wanted to see? Did it live up to the promise of what it, you know, what I thought it was supposed to be? That sort of thing. I don't care about the technical stuff. I mean, people work with what they have. And I think that's a thing, you know, being on the other side of it too. I'm a lot more sympathetic, I think, to things than other people would be if they have no knowledge of what goes into actually making something.
That is a common thread with independent filmmakers. When I talked to Matt Farley and Charles Roxburgh, the Shock Marathons guys, the Moturn Media, they had the exact same thing, where they found that their reviews, once they started making films and really, you know, churning out like a production, you know, then you see the nightmare of getting something finalized. So yeah.
Right. And it's not an easy job. Filmmaking is not an easy job, and independent filmmaking is an even harder job because you're doing multiple things. I mean, like, yeah, I'm the director, but I'm also making chili, and I'm also, you know, doing this, that, and the other thing, making sure people have water and you know, things like that. But yeah, you know, people don't think about that shit. You know, they watch Avengers and that had 95 people just to take care of Chris Evans' asshole, you know? I mean,
I mean, that's America's asshole. Yeah.
If he was on my set, I'd be wiping his asshole. See, people don't think about that. And that's the difference, folks, between Hollywood movies and independent cinema.
No one's taking care of my asshole, goddammit.
No, that's right. I don't have somebody to do that for me.
So I met this girl. I asked her to dinner and a movie. She asked, what do you have in mind? So I said,
make it a blockbuster night and a border night too. Go to Taco Bell, buy tacos or burritos and a medium drink. Get a free blockbuster video.
Coupon for a 2-for-1 blockbuster video rental when you buy food and a medium drink at Taco Bell. Cross the border.
What are some of your first memories of horror in any medium? I know we talked about your VHS days, but is there something that like really hit you at that perfect age, or maybe too young, that just scared you? Was there something that just made you the beautiful man you are today?
Some of my earliest memories would definitely be watching very old public domain horror on regional channels. That's what got me interested. Around that same time, there was the Crestwood books, the ones that would feature a different monster in each volume, and they'd tell you how different movies were shot and things like that. I don't know if you're familiar with those books, but our library had them, and they were just an amazing, amazing influence. And I always was into, you know, my parents were always into horror movies, and so I've always been exposed to them and been into them. And then conversely, the one time I can remember being totally terrified of a movie was when we went to see Close Encounters.
Oh my God. Yes.
And the scariest part of that movie for me, besides the part where the kid gets taken from the house, which yep. is horrifying, is the, when the ship, the doors first open and they send out that thing. I don't know even what it's supposed to be. It doesn't look like the other aliens.
No,
I don't know what it is. And it terrified me. That yes. thing scared the shit out of me. I don't even know what it's supposed to be. It's never explained. Is it one of them? He's just bigger. I don't know.
Yeah, it is iconic. And I think they just had, they want to get as many different types of freaking aliens in there. And so instead of really going into it at all, in any way at all, they just said, fuck it. This is crazy. We have to use this. And yeah, that's one of the magic things about, I love that movie. And that also scared the bejesus out of me as a kid.
Yeah. And that surprises people too. When you say that, they're like, you know, you weren't scared of horror movies as a kid. I'm like, no, but that thing was terrifying. And I still think about, like, even if I, you know, watch that movie to this day and that scene's coming up, I get all nervous. Like, I'm like, what the hell? I don't know.
One of the scariest movies experiences of my life was I was staying at my friend's house. I think I couldn't have been more than 12. Maybe I might have been 13. And the movie Communion was on the new release wall, and his mom rented, and we watched Communion, which is, it's now terrifying for the totally like over the top Christopher Walken. Is it Christopher Walken?
Oh no, it is Christopher Walken, the director of Howling 2 and 3.
Oh my God. Okay. So that director let him go guns a-blazing. Like, he is out and about. He's walking all over that film. Hey. And it's just like,
she was a big old slice of ham in that one, man.
But all the shit with the aliens, all the shit with how the aliens approach him and come after him, the motion detectors outside their remote cabin. And then when you finally have things in the corner of the room, it's like such a, like, in touch with a child's nightmare. And I was old enough to know better, but it still ended up with my friend and I insisting on sharing his bed because we needed to be close to each other to not be totally shitting ourselves.
Like two, like, cavemen. Like, you just need the constant contact to know that the night isn't going to come and eat you.
Oh, my God. It's like, I always think about that, like, that moment. And my grandmother wasn't there, but she was the one who tried to out me to my family. Like, she told everybody I was gay.
And I think when it was communion.
Just because she just thought I was gay. But, like, it still hasn't come true. I'm still waiting to see if I'm gay. I don't know. It was just one of those things where, you know, I was so scared that, you know, like, 1989 middle school homophobia did not get to me. And I was just clutching my friend in the darkness, like, for safety's sake.
There's parts of that are scary. If you live in a rural area, it's even scarier. The book was scary. The book that it's based on was scary.
Oh, I need to read that.
Oh, it's intense, man. Same name, Communion.
Nice. I will look for it.
Whitley Strieber, the guy that wrote The Wolfen.
Oh, my God. Love Wolfen. What a weird freaking movie. I love it. So what about like authors or horror stories, horror novels that have influenced you? Like, what are some of your people who've gotten to you, gotten under your skin over the years?
Well, definitely, you know, when I was growing up, Stephen King was the king. So you would read tons of Stephen King.
Oh, yeah.
I've always enjoyed Clive Barker. In fact, I gravitated, I'd say, as I got more into my older teenage years, I was probably more into Clive Barker because I was more, you know, drawn to gothy things and stuff like that. And he just fits into that whole scene too. And I was reading, you know, and I'd always read a lot of pulp stuff, Howard, Lovecraft. I mean, nothing too out of the ordinary as far as the authors are concerned.
Yeah. No, I was getting swept up in the Stephen King wave. Like, there was that 80s thing where you couldn't escape him. You could not get away from him. Like, even my parents, who they read a lot, but they were definitely bestseller, new release at the video store people. Like, whatever was hip, because they wanted to have stuff to talk about with people, you know. But that meant that as soon as Stephen King was the man dominating the frickin' bestseller list, they just picked him up like everything else. And next thing you know, I'm reading Misery when I'm 11. And it's like, what is happening to my brain?
Were they into that club, the Stephen King book club, where they'd send you like a different one of his novels each month?
Maybe they were, because we definitely had from I think we must have, because we had everything that era of like Misery and The Dark Half and Tommyknockers. Like, we always had those books like steadily pumping into our household, and I was more than happy. Like, one of my most precious memories as a kid was reading Tommyknockers over the summer, the summer it came out, and just being so swept away and hearing people like, whoa, 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 that's your favorite? And I'm like, well, yeah, dude. Like, the main character's a bad beat poet. You know, like, what? his poem is, "Hey, motherfucker." Like, I'll never forget that.
I mean, see? I mean, that's why everybody likes Stephen King.
See? But yeah, and then, you know, it's just, and falling out with him in the 90s, because like he started to do stuff that was weird and things that I would accept now.
Right.
Like the Insomnia was so weird and so out there that it literally made me angry enough to throw it in the dumpster when I finished it. Because I was so pissed that it wasn't a horror novel without metaphysical and basically a happy ending. You know, like the villains were actually part of the cycle of the universe and they were important. And it was also a spoiler alert. And, you know, spoiler alert for a 300-year-old book. Right. But it just enraged me. Whereas now I'd be like, man, this book is weird. I like it, you know?
Right. Yeah. I mean, it's weird how tastes change. Like, you know, when you're a kid, you look at comic books and you don't like Jack Kirby, but you look at him now and you're like, holy shit, this guy's awesome.
Oh my God. Like, and the only thing with Jack, thank you for even mentioning that. Like, he had some stories that were so purely Kirby that were amazing. And then at some point he needed a writer. And the DC and Marvel were so happy to have him back, you know, because he kept getting screwed by one company and going here and getting, you know, and then they just let him write and draw his stuff. And I feel like there was a point where they really should have paired him up with some hotshot writer. Mm-hmm. And it would have made, the latter half of his career a lot more successful. I mean, I still love, because like I was just, pick up any issue of The Eternals.
Right.
And just leave your brain like on the frickin' nightstand by your bed because you're done. Like, it's so perfect.
His concepts are just
wild.
I don't know. Yeah. You know, and there again, you know, I like that aesthetic, and I try to use that. Say, not that I'm Jack Kirby by any means, but I try to use that same aesthetic too, you know, just making it as imaginative and crazy as I possibly can.
I always find it really funny when he's like leaving the melodrama out, because of course I'm a big old frickin' soap opera craven person. Like, that's one of the things that makes my frickin' head explode for Marvel is like, oh my God, is Cyclops and Jean Grey going to get back together, bro? Like, that's like losing sleep because I need to read the next issue like a chump. Whereas Jack Kirby's like, I have characters that are dealing with a planet-sized spaceship. They don't have time for love, you know? And I'm like, where's the love, Jack?
Yeah, and I mean, I was just flipping through. I got a collection of Superpowers, you know, the series he did, two miniseries in the mid-80s. And the characters get stuck going through these dimensions. And in one dimension, they end up in, like, the goblets of these giant dead gods. I'm like, what the hell is this?
Oh my God, that's so cool.
I'm like, and it's a 2-page spread. And I'm like, what? And it means nothing. They're out of that dimension in a second. You know? But it's amazing.
Dude,
stuff. And
that's the thing that's so funny. Like, all of my comic book reading as a teenager was so limited by what I could afford. And it was the 90s, and the comic book market sucked donkey dicks. And so I couldn't look at back issues. I couldn't get a Jack Kirby comic for under $25 in 1993 money. So all I could do was read whatever was new. And so I didn't really understand space. So when I'm watching Guardians of the Galaxy and I'm like, why are these motherfuckers in space?
Right.
This is weird. And then looking at the cosmic stuff, I never knew about the Infinity Gauntlet. I never knew about Jack Kirby's work and his crossover stuff with DC, like, you know, the Eternals and what's it called? The Gods, something Gods.
The New Gods.
The New Gods. I knew none of that shit. And I knew none of that stuff existed. And now that I'm a grown up man baby and I can actually find these used copies of these collections on eBay, I'm reading more comic books than I ever even saw in my teenage years. And it's just, what a revelation.
Yeah. Yeah. I know. It's, and you know, and a lot of the stuff for me is the same way. When I was a kid, I wasn't really into superheroes. I'd read Conan comics and Star Wars, you know, stuff like, I was into that stuff for sure.
Oh, you God. Know, I read The Punisher. Blech.
Swamp Thing. Yeah.
90s Punisher, man. I look back at that now and I'm like, yikes.
Yeah, there's some rough. We're thinking of the same story. I'm not going to say a word, but but I read it and I was there when it came out, and I thought it was stupid.
I just loved Uzis. Give me an Uzi, I'm happy.
You get them too, because that's the most 80s 90s weapon you can possibly. but yeah, and you know, you were asking about authors earlier too, but it was weird because like. I'd say my influences, even though I write a lot, weren't really authors as much as movies or
just
weird shit that I'd see. You know what I mean? Like, things would just show up on TV. Kids don't realize this stuff now, man. They can find anything at any time. And I mean, I do too, and I love it. But
yes.
But there's nothing quite like waking up on a Saturday morning and throwing on the TV and... It's supposed to be like pro bowling, but instead they decided to show Super Inframan or something like that, you know?
Yeah. Or Elvira showing a Gamera super monster.
Right. Or, you know, I remember once I came home on an afternoon from being out with my parents and Star Crash was on.
Holy shit.
When I was a kid, I saw that movie as a child on TV.
Nice.
Crazy, you know, and that's just like one of my favorite movies of all time anyway.
Now I think what's going to happen is everyone has to have a weird uncle.
Right.
And not the pervy touchy kind, like the right. hopelessly nerdy uncle who's like, I'm not turning off this bonkers ass shit just because I've agreed to babysit this one time. And so this kid is seeing like some 80s mecha anime with people getting fried and they're robots, you know, like it changes their life.
It does. And I like, and you were asking about early memories about horror. I know you were asking like, you know, like super childhood, but like, I remember when I was like maybe 10 or 11 and I was hanging out with my older cousins and they had rented Dawn of the Dead and I'd never seen anything like that before. And I was like, this is, how do you do this? How do you put this on film and it comes out and people are like totally cool with it? I'm like, this is pretty fucking rad, man. I don't understand, you know? And then, you know, as time would go on, you know, you'd see like, I remember somebody had a copy of Evil Dead 2 and that was a revelation.
Oh my God. Yes.
And, like, I'd never seen anything, even though I'd seen Dawn of the Dead, it's a different animal. I mean, I'd never seen something so crazy gory and funny at the same time. I saw, of course, like a lot of people, I saw Evil Dead 2 way before I saw Evil Dead, but I missed the sense of video store revelations where like you would just pick something up because of the cover, because of somebody's cousin's brother had seen it and they said that there was some crazy shit in it. And you know, I mean, now it's so easy. I mean, it's a double-edged sword because it's so cool because we can get everything.
Yeah.
Literally.
It's wild.
But at the same time, we already know this. We're not buying this stuff blind. We've read reviews. We've watched videos. You know what I mean? Like, you know, you talk about it with your friends. Everybody's knows something about it. When I grew up, it was me and Shane. All my information came from him. And I still to this day don't know where the hell he got it.
What I think is neat is that there are free channels on like a Roku where you have the Film Rise channel and you have Tubi and stuff like that, where parents are like probably locking down the Showtime and they're locking down Netflix, but they're probably forgetting about the Tubi. And like, so there's going to be kids like, I want to watch zombies, and they're going to find some random ass public domain bullshit. You know, or an independent film. They're going to be watching. I think the crazy shit is you go to Amazon Prime and there's hundreds of indie films.
I know.
And it's like, God, man, the market is crazy.
And, you know, it's weird, too, because like it's really like, I know a lot of people are, you know, feeling negative, but my God, to be a film fan today is just it's absurd. It's our greatest fucking dreams have come true. Like anything we want, we can get.
If you are not one of those people with a magnifying glass on your 4K TV looking at the film grain, or you notice that the film is like cropped at one point,
right,
know, 185.2 instead of 185.16 or whatever. And you're, because there's so many people who are so spoiled.
Right.
You know, I didn't get my puzzle that was supposed to come with my pieces Blu-ray.
Oh, I know who you're talking about. I know exactly who you're fucking talking about.
That was famous. That was famous. I do have a Dawn of the Dead story. I think you'll like this. So
I have that puzzle too.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, you do. So I have a Dawn of the Dead story. You're going to love this. So in grade school, no, in sixth grade, so middle school, there was a kid who everybody picked on. He had a stuttering problem and they'd all pick on him for his stutter and I would stand up for him and everything. But he was like the first horror fan I was aware of. I'm sure I mingled among them once in a while unknowingly, but he was the first one who was out and about with his horror fandom. Mm-hmm. And he always had horror t-shirts. He always talked about horror movies. He had a Dawn of the Dead t-shirt and I asked him about what it was. And it was this zombie's head exploding. And I asked him, you know, what's that movie? It looks great. And he goes, oh, it's Dawn of the Dead. And I'm like, okay, cool. He's like, yeah, this is the king zombie. This is the king of the zombies in the movie. And I'm like, whoa. And he's like, yeah, they blow his head off with a grenade launcher. And I'm like, holy shit, I can't wait to see Dawn of the Dead. And, you know, like 2 years later, 13-year-old me rents Dawn of the Dead. I'm super psyched.
Mm-hmm.
That zombie's head explodes in that apartment building from the guy with the machine gun. I'm like, hold up. That wasn't the king of the zombies. That was just the dude in the apartment who gets his head blown off. And I realized that this
was like
this poor kid who was picked on every day. He just developed this defense mechanism by being a liar.
Right.
Or he was just literally messing with me because he thought I'd never watch it or something. But it was,
you want the king of the zombies? Here's the gunk.
maybe he wrote that movie. Maybe he's working on his magnum opus of the king zombie movie.
Can you even imagine? He probably... I was waiting for the revelation that I was like fucking Zack Snyder or something. I was like, oh.
And that boy grew up to be a dickhead. No, he's completely fine. I would defend him all over again if I had to. So, who are some of your favorite horror directors?
Let's see. We'll start with the obvious ones that everyone loves. John Carpenter.
Okay.
Sam Raimi. The guys, the dudes. I really love Shinya Tsukamoto, especially his earlier stuff. Like Tetsuo the Iron Man is one of my favorite films and one of my bigger influences. Only Shane has seen my college film, which steals from that exponentially.
That's amazing.
To the point where it's just like, what the fuck, dude? You should have just edited in scenes from that movie and just nobody's seen it. They would never know.
How did you get those effects?
Yeah, it's amazing. Why is everybody Japanese? What's going on?
That's makeup, dude. That's just
we live in the middle of the mountains in upstate New York. Well, where's all these Japanese people coming from? Actually, I joke, but that college that we attended there did have a large Japanese student body, and it was awesome because I had friends that would get tapes like straight from Japan. So we'd be watching like Yu Yu Hakusho and things like that, and I wouldn't know what was going on because I don't speak Japanese, but it was just cool to see it as it was fresh and new. I went off on a tangent there.
No, that's all right. That's important to my upbringing as well, is catching anime. I still haven't identified to this day, catching anime when I was six on local TV. They just had random, it could have been anything. Could have been, not Voltron, but like, is it Battle of the Planets? Is that that's an Italian space movie, isn't it?
No, Battle of the Planets was G-Force, Super Science.
Yeah. Exactly. I probably saw something like that. I probably saw something like Captain Harlock or something on TV as a kid.
For sure.
That just gets in your bloodstream, and you have to see more when you're a kid.
Yeah, no, the first anime that I definitely saw that I remember was Battle of the Planets, and the second one was Star Blazers, which is Space Battleship Yamato.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know why I say this stuff. If you're listening to this show, you will probably already know all this bullshit that I'm saying anyway. but yeah, and then it's just weird. Like you get exposed to certain things and it just sticks with you forever. You know, my here's a homespun tale, and then I'll get back on these directors and answer your fucking question. when I was a kid, the main industry in town was leatherworking. They'd get in skins from all over and cut them up and send them out and make gloves.
Oh, wow.
And my dad worked in one such factory, and he got a piece of white leather, and he went to the local Woolworths. I'm getting all mushy mouth. And he got a space helmet that sort of looked like they dress it, for people that don't know, they dress up like birds. And it had like that kind of bill thing on it.
Wow.
And he painted it white, and he put that cape on it, and he made me a belt. And that's like one of the biggest like memories of my dad, is like he made that suit.
Shit.
And I'm like, yeah, that was, and then people, and that's the thing. People are like, well, why do you still care about this shit? Because it's integral to our existence.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, people don't understand too, like the importance of these films. It can be a security blanket. It can be an inspiration. It can be anything. It doesn't even have to be the greatest film ever made. It can be fucking Attack of the Killer Tomatoes for all I know. whatever makes you happy.
Yeah.
You know?
I mean,
that's how I look at it.
I am a big fan of Toxic Zombies. It's mm-hmm. one of the most lackluster garbage zombie movies ever made, but it really defined my tastes in, like, I need more carnage. I need, mm-hmm. like, I went through the whole gore hound phase twice in my life, where I had to see the goriest of the gory, and just like a sleepy movie about hippies trying to grow pot, getting sprayed with stupid experimental weed killer, because it's killing the weed, bro.
Just doesn't seem fair, you know.
Like, now that it's legal, it's all legal. Right. But no, there's I am criminally nostalgic, and I don't care at all. What,
me too,
you know.
I drove my kids absolutely bonkers the other day, because they're like, what are some of the songs that, you know, because my kids really like the music that I listen to, and I like metal and things like that, but not, you know, screamy metal. I'm a big hair metal fan.
Yeah,
stuff like that,
of course.
Unapologetically. And but sometimes it's fun to just mess with the kids. So they're like, Dad, what are some of the songs you remember from growing up? And I put the theme from Super Snooper, you know, Super Fuzz. Did you ever see that movie?
Is that the one where it's the Italian
Sergio Corbucci, the guy that did Django?
Yeah, the king of the spaghetti depressedern.
The guy gets superpowers, yep. And he's a cop, and Ernest Borgnine's in it.
I saw that in the theaters, dude.
Oh my god!
Yep.
So I played them the theme song to that, "You're the Hunter from the Future," and Yeti, Giant of the 20th Century. I thought they were gonna kill me. By times the shit had reached its apex. I'd never seen such murderous children.
Their respect for you is going to take ages to recover. That's amazing.
I'm their dad. This is what they got. So... Anyway, we were talking about directors.
Yes.
So Raimi, Carpenter, Shinya Tsukamoto, Nobuhiko Obayashi, because Houseu is the best movie.
Oh, yeah.
Panos Cosmatos. I'm really into his stuff. All
Dude.
Two of them.
Oh, yeah. We're ready for more.
Yeah, exactly. I really love, and here's where it's going to take a nosedive. I really love Bruno Mattei.
No, that's a nose up. I love it.
Yeah, he's just it's just genius, the things that he can do. And you know, I'd even throw Fregasso in there too, because sometimes they're interchangeable. For better or for worse. Yeah, those are the ones that really stand out. Ed Wood, of course, is always a huge inspiration with his work, not so much his personal drinking habits, but
yeah.
Yeah, so there you go.
Those are great. That's heady stuff, just to to say the least. Yeah, we do have an episode of Simon and I geeking out on Beyond the Black Rainbow. So
it's so good. It's so good. God.
Yeah.
It's so Mandy was every bit as good.
Yeah. I'm more Black Rainbow, but I am also, I mean, I love Mandy, but yeah, there's something about that, you know, not for anyone who hasn't seen Beyond the Black Rainbow, just freaking go watch it. That last shot where it gets to me.
I'm not going to tell people how to live their lives, but I wouldn't necessarily watch that film sober.
That's my problem, is I watch it like criminally sober.
Christ.
The cops come and give me a beer. Like, dude, come on.
Here, take this. You're going to need this.
And of course, Simon and I, spoiler alert for that episode, we go on a long tangent about drugs. So it's great.
Good.
Good times.
As it should be. Yeah, that's an amazing movie. Like I wasn't prepared for that movie at all when I watched it, but boy, was I glad I did.
Yeah. Well, dude, we did the talking. We did this.
Yes, we did.
So I know folks can find your movie reviews at horrorfuel.com. What are some other resources to get people get their damn fix?
Well, if you would like to watch Ouija Room, it is currently available on Tubi TV, which is free. It is also on Amazon Prime, as is Fred Olen Ray's Boggy Creek, the Bigfoot series, which I wrote episodes 3 through 6 of.
Nice.
And if you Google Weekly Spooky, you can listen to our weekly podcast of scary stories, a different story each week. We are on our 100th episode, so it's a two-parter with multiple stories. It's got some real corkers in there, let me tell you. I got one in there. Shane's got one in there. Yeah, there's some good ones.
Nice. Well, I will provide links to everything, to all this, so folks can find it easily. And, awesome. Dude, just thank you for talking to me. Thank you for taking the time. I appreciate it.
Hey, no problem, man. Anytime.
Long overdue. And
yeah, for sure.
Next time we'll get a little kinkier.
I mean, this was pretty vanilla, bro.
Of course, I know. You know, I don't want to shock people right off the bat. But it's like a Mapplethorpe over here as I talk to
you. You have been fidgeting in your chair a lot. I figured there was something up there. I'm proud of you.
Yeah, that's me, Mr. Fidgety.
Well, folks, thanks for listening. Take care. Go seek out Dan's stuff. And we'll talk to you later.
Bye. Bye.
Hello, This Is the Doom Show is a proud member of the Legion Podcast Network. Please check out the other podcasts on legionpodcasts.com. If you'd like more Hello, This Is the Doom Show, go to hellodoomshow.podomatic.com or go to doomedmoviethon.com for the archives. If that's still not enough, go to @doomedmoviethon on Twitter. You can write in to Hello, This Is the Doom Show. Use the email doomedmoviethon@gmail.com. Doom Show episodes are available on record and 8-track cassette.